KGST Fresno, la 1600 AM.
El siguiente efecto será apagado por la emisión de PL600 AM y no se hace responsable por las opiniones reflejadas en su contenido.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Damrgurdichyan. Well, we were just entering our third week of classes at Fresno State, so things are getting pretty busy. We have lots of events, and we have a special new event coming up, which actually deals with Armenian music. It's going to be called the Armenian American Musical Heritage Day of the San Joaquin Valley. We're holding this on Saturday, February the 29th. And what we're doing is encouraging people in the community to bring with them to this event various kinds of memorabilia and materials dealing with Armenian music from the 20th century. So we're planning to hold this event between 1 and 3 p.m. on the 29th. It's going to be at the University Business Center. We're looking for people that can bring memorabilia, advertisements, promotional materials, historic photos of musicians, venues, picnics, sheet music. And then what we're going to do is digitize these and we'll be able to give them right back to you. But in this way, we'll be able to develop our archive of Armenian music. The Armenian Studies Program now has over 1,000 records from this period. I'm talking about the 20th century of Armenian American music. So we're going to add to this with this special event that we'll be holding. And then between 3:30 and 5 o'clock on the same day in the same place, we're going to have a special presentation, discussion, and performance by oud master Richard Hagopian with Dr. Yektan Turkyomaz, who will be coming from Germany especially to talk about Armenian music. And then we'll hear a performance by oud master Richard Hagopian. All of this is going to be free admission and free parking. It is a Saturday, so there's free parking. It's at the University Business Center at Fresno State. So tell your friends, and if anybody has materials that we're talking about, anything dealing with Armenian American music, please have them get that ready and bring it by. And if you have any questions, you can always call our office at the Armenian Studies Program at 278-2669. Now, as I said, we've already begun a very active series of events, and last week we had a lecture by Sato Mughalian, who talked about her grandfather, David Ohanessian, who brought the Armenian ceramic industry to Jerusalem. And so we're going to interview her today and talk to her a little bit about her talk and then also about her book.
This is All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Damrgurdichyan, and my guest today is author Sato Mughalian, who is the author of Feast of Ashes, The Life and Art of David Ohanessian. And she spoke last week at Fresno State on the topic of David Ohanessian and the Armenian ceramics of Jerusalem. Welcome, Sato.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So the book that you wrote was on about your grandfather.
Yes.
And it really chronicles this very intriguing long journey from his hometown in Kutaya, Turkey, Ottoman Turkey, to Jerusalem and then on.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the story to start with,
sure.
About his story and how you got interested in writing about it.
Sure. So he was actually born in an Armenian village, an ethnically Armenian village called Muradja in the province of Bursa in 1884. And as you mentioned, he went to Kutahya. He apprenticed and mastered the art of ceramics. And in 1907, he opened his own workshop there. In the Young Turk era, there was a big movement toward modernization and renovation of historic monuments, which gave a boost to his career and the career of the other two workshops in Kutahya. But then, of course, once the Ottomans entered the First World War, things changed for the Armenians. And although Kutahya had a governor who protected Armenians from deportation, he didn't last very long. He was removed by the government, and my grandfather was arrested at the end of 1915, deported to Syria along with his family, and spent about 3 years living as a refugee there. Through a series of bizarre and amazing, miraculous coincidences, he was brought by the British from Aleppo to Jerusalem to participate in a planned British restoration of the Dome of the Rock. This is after the British had conquered Jerusalem at the end of 1917. And he established a workshop there, and the work that he produced and the work that his followers produced is still like very much a characteristic of the city, and more people have entered the profession. It's a thriving profession now, and I wanted to kind of hone in on a more accurate telling of his life story. So I spent about a decade researching in archives and following his traces around the world, and then I wrote this book.
I've read the book, and I was reading parts of it, and it's so intriguing. How did you actually get the inspiration to write about it? What was the spark that actually got you interested to do all of that research?
Well, aside from absolutely adoring his artistic work, I knew that the story of his life was quite dramatic, more dramatic than had been told by art historians previously. So everybody in my family contributed. My mother, before she died in 1995, wrote down all the stories that had been passed down through oral tradition in our family over centuries, actually. My aunt Sirarpi had maintained a collection of documents from the workshop in Jerusalem, as well as a few documents from Kutahya. And then my cousins had, you know, collectively photographs, letters, legal documents, visas, passports, etc. And so as I got more and more kind of engrossed in this quest to piece together a more accurate portrait of his life, you know, I was able to pull together all these resources and to corroborate the story that we had in our family with archival documents and piece it all together into a narrative work.
So he was born in that small village, and how far back do you believe that you can go back with your family? You said centuries, so how far back were you able to trace your family's history,
well,
the region at least?
In this oral narration that was preserved by my mother, she said that my grandfather's ancestors had moved from the eastern Euphrates region to Muradja around the year 1500. And, you know, when I went to see what was going on, there was Ottoman incursion there, and there were, you know, things were very bad for Armenians in that Erzurum, eastern Euphrates region. And then I found articles in the Armenian National Library from the late 19th century that also repeated that the community had moved as a whole to form a new colony, you know, over near Eskişehir. So around 1500. In the Ottoman archives, there were census documents going back to the mid-19th century, which gave me the names of some of my ancestors, names that I didn't know. So basically, that's what I learned.
So the story started, you said, with him as a young boy apprenticing as a ceramicist. Is that right? Or how did he actually then kind of get into it, and then what... how did he really take it to the next level, I guess, in a sense?
Well, as a child, he learned that he was in part descended from Ceramicus. So Muracha, which is today called Muracha, there's just the barest remnant of a once thriving village there. The Armenians who lived there, some of them sent men to both to Kutahya and to Ushak to learn carpet making. And so my grandfather's father, for example, was a fabric dyer, and his great-grandfather was a fabric printer. So, you know, people there farmed for their subsistence, but they also excelled in certain crafts. And traditionally, people had left Muracha for Kutahya. So he knew that was in his background. And when he was 17, he had fallen madly in love with his cousin, Victoria. And so the combination of needing to make something of himself, to prove himself to her parents, and also to satisfy his own aesthetic instincts, which drew him to the art of ceramics. He went to Kutahya, mastered the art, and continued, as we just said.
And as I was reading your book, it's a very interesting process, the whole process of creating the ceramics. Mm-hmm. And it's also very much location sensitive, meaning the materials.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that, as far as, you know, it has to be a certain type of material, clay
yeah.
or other things. So
exactly.
Yeah,
it's a very localized art, and it's one of several very localized arts that Armenians practiced in that region. I mean, another example is what Germans call meerschaum, and what Armenians and Turks call lule daşe, which is the carved miniature sculptures, pipe heads, all these sorts of things that are made from this mineral, sepulite, which is found near Eskişehir and near Kütahya and in very few other places in the world. So that's one example of an art that had tremendous Armenian participation, which, you know, once the genocide diaspora happened, they weren't necessarily able to recapture that. So it's a geologically complex region, this part of northwest, what today is Turkey. It's the meeting of many continental plates. And so this clay called kaolin, which is the white sort of china clay that gives the characteristic glowing white background to Kütahya and Iznik ceramics, is found in abundance there. But it doesn't exist in Palestine. I mean, the clay, the basic clay that they had in Palestine was infused with iron, so it had a reddish tinge. So, yeah, that art, as you mentioned, the ceramic art, was very much tied to the region. And it wasn't just the clay. It was the minerals from which they ground the glazes and...
So, you know, I teach an art class, and in that art class we talk a lot about the 18th century Kütahya mm-hmm. tiles, especially the tiles that went to decorate St. James Church Cathedral in Jerusalem, and also the beautiful materials that were as orders for wealthy hojas and mm-hmm. others. So this is a long-standing tradition of working in ceramics in Kütahya.
Yeah.
So as your grandfather then grew older, so the genocide occurred very quickly right after that, right, for him, as far as, I mean, at what age was, what? How old was he at the time of 1915?
Well, okay, so he had his career in Kütahya from 1907, I mean, as a professional, because he was an apprentice mm-hmm. before that, from 1907 to the end of 1915. So he was born in 1884. So he was a young man
arrested. Brief. I mean, he's just getting to his, you know, peak. Not even at his peak, actually.
No, well, actually, I would argue that that's not necessarily the case uh-huh. because he was enormously prolific uh-huh. in Kütahya. And, as you saw in the book, like the works that they produced not only went to Cairo and to the baronial estate of Sir Mark Sykes in Yorkshire, England, mm-hmm. where, you know, many British military officers and foreign service officers saw Ohanessian's work, mm-hmm. but the three Kütahya studios in the years 1913, 1914 were commissioned to make the tiling for the future tomb of the penultimate Ottoman Sultan, Reshad V. So in Istanbul today, you can see many examples, architectural tile work of the Kutahya ceramicists, and also the entire interior of the tomb of Reshad V, which is largely Armenian tiles.
So your story that you chronicled, his grandfather's story, is in a way the story of many Armenians who lived in the Ottoman Empire, displaced by genocide, and mm-hmm. then moving often once, twice, until they found a place that they could live.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that period of the immediately following the genocide. So a little bit about his path from Kutaya to Jerusalem, maybe a couple of things that
sure.
were stand out in his journey.
Yeah. Well, they were deported toward Aleppo, and they ended up spending a period of time in Aleppo as refugees, as did tens of thousands of other Armenian survivors in those years, 1915, 1916, 17. But he was deported a second time from Aleppo to Meskene. And the family arrived in Meskene at the beginning of 1917. So the worst of the massacres there was over, but there was still kind of a camp
death
of
camps,
Armenians
Meskene was
living
famous,
along the
yeah.
river. So he was there. It's a long story, and I won't tell the whole story now because I have to leave something for the readers to
right,
discover.
Exactly.
But in the end of 1918, when the British conquered Aleppo, Mark Sykes, who had commissioned Ohanessian to make this magnificent, huge tile drum, which is still in situ in Sledmere House in Yorkshire, came on a British Foreign Office mission to Aleppo to set up a provisional administration. And he had several tasks assigned to him by the government. One of them was to interview the Armenian survivors in Aleppo and investigate what the possibilities might be for them to repatriate, to return to their original villages. And in this intense period of interviewing Armenians, he re-encountered my grandfather. Sykes had just passed through Jerusalem, where the new military governor, Ronald Storrs, had taken him for a walk through the old city. And he saw the need to restore the tiling of the Dome of the Rock. And the British were very, very motivated to want to address this. I mean, they wanted to address the damage to all the holy sites, but especially the Dome of the Rock. And they started sending messages out, like, where can we find tiles? How can we do this? And they were also terrified because here they were, these Christian military men wanting to restore one of the holiest sites in Islam. So it was appealing to them because they were all, you know, classicists and interested in archaeology and history mm-hmm. and all that. But it was also tremendously frightening because they thought, what happens if we do a bad job? What happens if there's damage under our watch? So it was a subject that they paid great attention to. A number of the British, I discovered, remembered Ohanessian from seeing his work at Sledmere House, but they had no idea where he was. So at the point where Mark Sykes re-encountered him at the end of 1918, the conditions were already set, and Sykes facilitated his travel to Jerusalem, where he and the family were assigned a room in the Vank, the Armenian Vank, and where they lived for 3 years.
So what was the story about the losses of his immediate family, or, you know, how big a family were they, and how many were able to survive to get to Jerusalem?
His family scattered. They scattered, and some of them were reunited with him later in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So some went to Cairo.
So some survived.
Some survived. Some died.
Many lost. Were lost.
Many were lost. The whole village of Moracha, his birth village, where much of his extended family had continued to live, was deported in one single day in August of 1915. They were given basically 24 hours to pack whatever they could and to leave. And I've always wondered, I mean, I haven't actually read much scholarship about this, but I'm very curious about, I mean, we know that the Western provinces were mainly deported, I mean, en masse in August of 1915. That was just at the time they would have been starting to be ready to harvest their crops. And, you know, with all the difficulties that the Ottomans had in food supply for the Ottoman mm-hmm. armies and all that, I've always wondered about that, the timing of that, you know.
Well, many Ottomans lost their lives because there was hunger and famine and disease, and it was because they had eliminated the Armenian or deported the Armenian population, which was the food-producing part of the population.
Exactly. But in the case of Muratça, within weeks, the Ottomans had given the Armenian homes to Balkan Muslim refugees who had entered Anatolia as refugees.
Well, this was very common. So already the lists were prepared in most areas that they already had the list. They knew who was there. They knew who was going to move in. And they did that pretty systematically throughout the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah. And from what I understand, like, you know, an artisan would be given an artisan studio. A farmer would be given a piece of farmland or whatever. So, you know, it's yet another tragic, poignant thing for us to think about.
But then again, your grandfather, so he's here as he's in Jerusalem as a refugee, no particular work at this point. It's a terrible time. I mean, we're talking about early 20s, I mean, late
1918. I mean, he arrived in December of 1918.
Oh, so already pretty early.
Not only that, but the British were actively looking for someone who could start a ceramic studio in Jerusalem. You know, a number of people had come in. E.T. Richman, the architect, who was a consultant for the Dome of the Rock, who had sort of established his credentials in Cairo over the previous years, overseeing restoration of Islamic monuments there. He had a very good reputation in the Muslim community, and so he was granted a lot of freedom. He came a year earlier and began surveying the condition of the Dome of the Rock. Charles Ashby, who's a figure known in the arts and crafts movement, had come from Cairo to Jerusalem at the invitation of Ronald Storrs to examine the state of crafts in Jerusalem and in Palestine, and to sort of advise the government on all kinds of different projects relating to that. Governor Storrs founded an organization called the Pro-Jerusalem Society, and his intent was to invite people from all three of the major faiths to cooperate in the sort of restoration of Jerusalem. So by the time Ohanessian arrived, the Pro-Jerusalem Society had been founded several months earlier, and they supported him in setting up an experimental workshop on the Haram Sharif at first, and then working with the Muslim leaders to give him this workshop to use on the Via Dolorosa, which ultimately became his. So the conditions were ripe. They needed a ceramicist. They wanted not only to establish a ceramics tradition there for the retiling of the Dome of the Rock, but also to put to work some of the many thousands of refugees and orphans who were living there. Some of the orphans were supported by Near East Relief, and Near East Relief had like a well-structured program to feed, house, and educate orphan children throughout the region. And the idea was to place them in apprenticeships so that by the time they reached the age of 16, they would be self-sufficient. Near East Relief placed a number of orphans with my grandfather, even from those first months there, and he trained them, as he had done in Kutahya, in all the aspects of the art, and some of them stayed with him until 1948.
My guest today is Sato Mughalyan. She's the author of a book called Feast of Ashes, The Life and Art of David Ohanessian. David Ohanessian is her grandfather. We're going to take a short break on All Things Armenian, and we'll be back after the break to continue our conversation.
Tune in to All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural, 1600 AM.
Thank you.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural, 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Dermagradichian. My guest today is author Sato Mughalyan, who's speaking about her grandfather, David Ohanessian, and we're discussing his life story and about how he established an Armenian ceramics industry in Jerusalem. So Thank you for joining me again today, Sato.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So we were talking about your grandfather, and he had arrived in Jerusalem, and then he was enlisted, in a sense, or encouraged to sort of establish an industry of creating ceramics. So tell us a little bit about maybe some of the challenges he had in that.
Yes, it's correct to say that he was enlisted to do it, but that we must also acknowledge the agency of Armenian survivors who, in many different fields, took it upon themselves to find ways to recreate their arts or to create new arts, and that was very much the case with him as well, although that's not so well recognized by the mostly British historians who've written about Jerusalem ceramics. So the main problem in Jerusalem in those early years was the lack of appropriate materials, as we discussed earlier. There wasn't clay. There weren't the minerals to make the glazes. And so Ohanessian, in 1919, about 7 months after he had arrived, asked the British military administration to give him safe transit papers to return to Kütahya and obtain materials to bring back for the restoration of the Dome of the Rock. He went in August, and when he was there, you know, things were pretty dire. The Armenian community had not entirely dispersed, but they were in very straitened circumstances for obvious reasons. Additionally, there was the conflict between the Greeks and the Turks, which was moving toward Kütahya. So he invited the remaining Armenian ceramicists of Kütahya to return to Jerusalem with him, and a number of them accepted his invitation. Some of them ended up going to Greece, but among those were Mugurdich Karkashian, who was a very highly skilled painter of ceramics, and Nishan Balyan, who was a great potter. I mean, he was a master of the wheel. And so they and others came back and joined him, Ohanessian, in his new workshop on the Via Dolorosa, where they set about training more orphans, doing what they could to set up a commercial tradition, so that while they were involved in the restoration of the Dome of the Rock, they could also start producing ceramics to sell to the tourists and the pilgrims who were slowly beginning to return to Jerusalem. And, of course, as we know, the Balyan and Karakashian families are still producing gorgeous ceramics today. Maybe we'll talk later about the current generation Armenian ceramicists in Jerusalem.
So then your grandfather began the workshop, and it grew, right? I mean, so it became a very popular and a big enterprise. How many people did he hire? How many people did he work for him?
I think at the peak there were probably like 40 ceramicists. There's a very strong division of labor in the traditional way of producing ceramics, which he maintained to the end of his career. That is to say, there were those young men who prepared the clay and ground the glazes, and all of this was done by hand. And it was grueling work because, you know, you take the clay, you have to put it through sieves, you know, you mix it, you cure it, all of this. There were those who were pattern designers. There were those who painted those patterns, and even that was divided into parts. Men would trace the designs, and often women would fill in the colors. So he maintained this kind of division of labor throughout his career, like to the end of his career in 1948. And I think he was the last one to use a wood-fired kiln. And that was a whole production in itself, because you would judge the temperature by the color of the flame. The cycle will go overnight, so someone would have to be with the kiln, you know, moving the wood around and making sure the temperature remained constant, and then changed when it was supposed to change. So it was very, very labor intensive.
So ceramics, Armenian ceramics in particular, maintain the very vivid colors, the bright colors that I think even come from, I would say, Armenian miniatures. But can you tell us something about the popular patterns? What, where were they inspired by? Maybe if he ever talked about in an oral history way, what he was inspired to in terms of the patterns?
Well, he never talked to me because, sadly, he died before I was born. But I could see from the remaining books and documents and papers and everything that, you know, I mean, he definitely used what we call Islamic design as one kind of inspiration. And that was also in part because he did a lot of architectural tile work. But in Jerusalem, the range of iconography expanded, and he began incorporating more Christian symbols. I think he was directly inspired by some Armenian illuminations. He used Crusader imagery. So it was wider, but he continued to work in a traditional style. And what he did was he worked incrementally. So, I mean, I don't think it was ever his goal to, like, wildly change the range of images that were used. But, you know, he was always trying to achieve that kind of glowing white background. I mean, in Jerusalem, obviously, he had the problems with material. So he worked to find a way that he could use the reddish soil, clay of Palestine, and find a slip that would, you know, mask some of it. So a lot of this progress was incremental. The next generation started importing more materials. They used a gas-fired kiln. So their set of issues was different from his. But in a sense, he preserved, you know, the centuries-old techniques of ceramic production in his studio.
Did your family at all continue? Did anyone continue within the family after your grandfather passed away?
Well, he trained his two sons, and they worked full-time in the studio, but the family scattered in 1948 because their neighborhood in West Jerusalem came under a lot of violence, and he was forced to close the workshop in the old city to, like, board it up. And he stayed until April of 1948. Everybody else had left for Cairo or Damascus or, you know, and they assumed that they would be returning soon. They didn't think this was going to last for a long time, but sadly, they became stateless, and they couldn't return. So, you know, things were politically complicated and then practically complicated as well.
So no family members are in the art today. I mean, there's no any more Ohanessian relatives directly in the ceramic business?
Or? Unfortunately not.
Yeah. But then he did train some others, the Karakashians and the Balians. Can you tell us a little bit about that process, what happened with it? And
well, they were already highly skilled in their in the aspects of their work, and I believe that they wanted to join him as partners, and he wanted to remain a sole proprietor. So in 1922, they founded a new studio on Nablus Road outside the old city. And so that was really the planting of Armenians, because now there wasn't just one, but there were two Armenian studios, and there was a bit of competition, healthy competition there. And, you know, they experimented with different colors and patterns and all of that. And then much later in the 50s, I believe, Marie Balian, who was a painter from Lyon, married into the family, and she greatly expanded the kind of images that were used in the Balian ceramics. And, you know, the Balians have continued experimenting with new technologies, new techniques for producing tiles, and they make a lot of products that they export around the world. Even in Los Angeles, some people have swimming pools with Balian, very beautiful tile liners for their pools, and also in the UAE, elsewhere in the world. The Karakashians have maintained this gorgeous, like, hand-painted, hand-produced tradition of pottery and tile making. So there's a certain amount of overlap, but they're also quite distinct from each other. Then there are other families who joined in, the Sandruni families, three brothers, all very skilled ceramicists. Vic Lepegin, a fantastically interesting artist whose studio is right outside the St. James complex in Jerusalem. And not only does he work with ceramics, but he uses ceramics in a sort of metaphysical way. Like, he breaks them and uses them in newly made artworks. There's also Hagop Antriassian, who makes, you know, monumental tile works and pottery. And it's really gorgeous. All of them have websites. All of them are connected with the world. All of them have Facebook pages. It's very easy to reach them. They can be commissioned for a wide range of works, from architectural, kitchen, backsplashes, all of these things, to religiously themed Armenian ceramics. So I highly encourage your listeners to give them a look, certainly to visit the studios when they go to Jerusalem, but to keep them in mind when they or their friends and neighbors are renovating their homes.
You were talking about it a little bit earlier, but can you tell us about some of the commissions that your grandfather did have? So other places that you can see his work today, in Jerusalem in particular, but other places you mentioned in England, but are there other good examples maybe you can?
Yes. My aunt Serarpi, in the last year of her father's life, made a list of his major works. And so I spent years kind of tracking them down, which was tricky because the names of places have changed, all of that. But for example, there's a wonderful bed and breakfast in Corbie, France, in the Somme region of France. So for people who are visiting the sites of World War I history, highly recommend this as a place to stay. Two townhouses that were combined into a single residence. The owner of that house in 1925, I believe it was, met my grandfather at a Paris International Exposition and commissioned him to make an entirely tiled room. That room remains in perfect condition, quite dramatic. We discovered that there's a church in Brooklyn, New York, that has a chapel that contains Ohanessian tiled altar. So, you know, there are a number of places. And, of course, his tiles from the Kutahya era remain on a number of buildings in Istanbul today. People see them. They don't really know where they're from. But these were made from the three ceramic studios that were thriving in the years just before the First World War.
Yeah, and as part of your research, I think you went back, did you not? You said you had gone back to Muratsha once, twice?
Once.
And tell us, you said there wasn't much left, but did the local population remember the Armenians or remember the work done there?
Well, it was very hard to find because it's not even really on very many historic maps. So, I mean, I had only a few clues. My mother had said it was a two-day mule ride from Eskishehir. So I actually contacted the American Mule Museum in Bishop, California, and they were very helpful. I said, how far can you travel with, you know, loaded donkeys over two days? So they helped me figure out that I was looking at basically a 40-mile radius around Eskishehir. I went to the map library at Columbia and looked through 150 historic maps, searching in that region for Muratsha or any variant of the name. No luck. And finally, it was the map librarian of the New York Public Library, who, as it turns out, is also Armenian, Nancy Kandoyan, who found me a German map from 1907 of the Bursa province. She sent it to me. You know, I looked at it very carefully, and sure enough, there was a village called Muratsha. So a friend of mine overlaid Google Maps, figured out where the remnants of this village were, and some friends drove me there. It's inhabited by maybe 12, 70, 80-year-old descendants of the Balkans who had moved there. And what we discovered is that still, all throughout that region, people call it the Armenian village. It's called Muratsha, but it's known as the Armenian village. There are no Armenians there, but there's still the memory of Armenians being there because it was a thriving community. Probably at the time of the deportations, there were 2,500 Armenians there, silk growers, fruit growers, grape growers, winemakers, all gone in a single day. And now just these elderly people who are still farming, but they are the ones who like carry memory because they had heard stories from their parents and grandparents and they remembered them.
You're an artist yourself. You perform on the flute. You're
yes.
a flautist.
Yes.
Is that something you feel is part of the family tradition? I mean, art in a different way?
Well, my grandfather was a very musical person. Evidently, he had a beautiful voice. Mm-hmm. And over the course of his life, he met Gomidas several times, who, as you know, of course, was born in Kutahya.
Mm-hmm.
So Gomidas returned there a couple of times, and my grandfather met him at that point, and was in one of the choruses, you know, learned all the songs.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather taught those songs to my mother. My mother taught them to me. I think the drive to devote your life to some aesthetic pursuit mm-hmm. must come from him. And I know from everything that I read about him that, like, no matter what hardship he faced, he was always trying to find a way to make art. So that was very inspiring.
Are there artists in other branches of your family? I mean, in the extended family?
Yes, there are. I have cousins who are both librarians and poets, librarians and painters, librarians and artists. So we have a lot of librarians and a lot of teachers, and people express themselves in all sorts of artistic ways.
So you were telling me, I think earlier we had a conversation about, you had found some of the material about your grandfather in an interesting place, right? Kind of some place that had been forgotten about, and then, like...
Yeah. Yes. My Aunt Sorarpi's archive, as it turned out, was buried in my cousin's garage in L.A., and there was a period toward the beginning of my process when I was really hounding my cousins to go through their closets and drawers and attics and everything. And at that point, my cousin Armin Markaryan and his wife Jean decided to clean out their garage in L.A., and they found this big box stuffed with papers, mm-hmm. and they just took it to the post office, express mailed it to me. And when I opened it, I found so many answers to things that I had, you know, big questions about that I had not been able to answer through research. And my cousin in Jerusalem, my cousin Alice Ohanessian, her father, who was one of the sons who had mastered the art at her father's side, had written a detailed instruction book for every step of making Armenian ceramics in the way that my grandfather practiced it in
that's
Jerusalem.
That's really fascinating. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you've been now, you've published the book and you're traveling and speaking. Where have you been
yeah.
so far in your
so
travels?
So I've given a couple of talks in London, in Armenia, in France, in Spain, in different places in the United States. Lots of talks in the New York mm-hmm. area. I'm very honored to have been invited to have spoken at Fresno, mm-hmm. in such an important Armenian center,
yeah.
and such an important Armenian studies department, you know, worldwide. It's, you know, famous, and you've contributed so much to our understanding of Armenian history. I'm going to be giving the Dr. Berge Haydostian talk at University of Michigan, mm-hmm. Ann Arbor in March.
Oh, great. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so these are all huge honors. And additionally, you know, because this has been covered in the Israeli press, I have been invited to speak at Brandeis University in April on the day that falls between a Holocaust Remembrance Day and Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. So, you know, it's an honor to represent from an artistic point of view how these massive, massive disruptions and episodes of mass violence have intersected with artistic traditions.
Have you given any thought to having the book translated into either Armenian or into maybe another language? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I would be very, very interested. There's some interest in Turkey, in translating it into Turkish. You know, we'll see if that happens.
I think that would be a great thing, yeah. Turkish would definitely bring it to a large audience. I think there would be
yeah.
a lot of interest in it.
Yeah, because, I mean, it was not exclusively in Armenian art. One of my grandfather's partners, his senior partner, was Mehmet Emin, who was Turkish. So, you know, these are Armenians and Turks working side by side in this small place, which is somewhat removed from the capital. You know, Kütahya was an interior county. And so, you know, this is like part of world heritage, and people should know. I mean, certainly Armenians know, and perhaps there's more for them to know, but people all over the world should also know.
Great. It's been my pleasure today to have as my guest Sato Mughalyan. She's the author of Feast of Ashes, and she was a guest at the Fresno State Armenian Studies Program, speaking about her grandfather, David Ohanessian, and the Armenian ceramics of Jerusalem. Thank you very much for joining me today on All Things Armenian.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and we'll be back soon.
Welcome
back. Tune in to All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM. Presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Demirgradichian. Today, we had an interview with Sato Mughalyan, who had given a talk at Fresno State last Tuesday. And Sato is a very accomplished flutist. And during our program today, we heard four songs from a CD that is called Oror Lullaby, Armenian Music for Flute and Harp. And it featured a performance by Sato Mughalyan on flute and Alyssa Wright on the harp. And the songs that we heard today were Shogherjan, Haberban, Oynazan, and Tamzar. A very beautiful arrangement of Armenian music to flute and to harp. Now, as I said earlier today, we have a very, very packed series of events coming up at Fresno State. And I want to first talk about what's coming up this Friday, February the 7th, at 7:30 p.m. at Fresno State. Dr. Ari Shakarian, who is the Kazan Visiting Professor in Armenian Studies, will be giving the first in a three-part public series of talks called An Untold Story of Survival, the Armenian Community in Istanbul During the Armistice Years. That's the period between 1918 and 1923. Dr. Shakarian is teaching a course at Fresno State this spring. He comes to us from the University of Oxford, where he defended his doctoral dissertation. Last year, he was an honorary fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he was born and raised in Istanbul. So it's going to be a very interesting presentation. It's free admission to everyone. And actually, we're going to be holding a reception from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Right before the lecture, and we'll be having some light hors d'oeuvres and food and refreshments, and there'll be a chance for you to meet with Dr. Shakarian before the lecture. So come on out to the University Business Center at 6:30 p.m. for the reception and 7:30 for the talk by Dr. Ari Shakarian. And we've been talking just the last few weeks about the Merhuis House of Hope program in Armenia. And the program is one which is very close to my heart because I'm very much involved with that program. I'm a vice president of its U.S. Organization. And the Merhuis program reaches out to girls from severely disadvantaged lifestyles in Armenia. And what it does is to provide a residential program. So the girls actually live at the facility, and where it teaches these young women the skills needed to lead productive adult lives. I've been involved in this program since 2008, so it's been almost 12 years. We actually opened for our first class of girls in 2012, where we brought 18 girls between the ages of 13 and 15 to live and to work at this facility. And we've really been able to do a lot with our staff. So we raise money every year to support this program. And so the Armenian Studies program is co-hosting a benefit concert for the House of Hope Merhuis. It will be held on Saturday, February the 22nd at 7 p.m. That's on a Saturday, so there is free parking. You do need to get tickets, and if you're interested in getting tickets, just give us a call at the Armenian Studies program at Fresno State, and we will tell you all the details about it. And it's going to be a concert which will feature some very interesting guests. It's going to be having some vocal artists coming from Los Angeles. Lauren Movsesian, Clarice Compton, and Colette Compton will be singing various songs from popular and Armenian music. Michael Krikorian, a native Fresno Armenian, and who has his doctorate in piano, will be performing. And we also will have a trio with him and also a cellist and a violinist. So it'll be a full program from 7 to about 8:30 p.m. And again, it will start at 7 p.m. on Saturday, February the 22nd. Anyone that's interested in seeing about our upcoming programs, please visit our website at fresnostate.edu/Armenian Studies. Or you can follow us on Facebook. Facebook is a really good way for a lot of people to stay in touch with us. And on Facebook, we've got a great page which just gives us all the information, and you can find out about the events that are coming up. I just did a count how many different events we have this semester, and it's up there at 13 events that we're going to be having. So that's quite a few events, and we hope that you'll join us for at least some of these events that we're talking about. And beginning in March, we have a full full series of activities, as well as the concert that I've already mentioned to you. So lots of things going on at Fresno State, lots of interesting things. So you can always join us on the Facebook page to talk about that. And then I just want to conclude today by talking about the Armenian Studies Program banquet, which will be held on Sunday, March the 22nd. That's our annual banquet. This year will be the 32nd anniversary banquet, and we're going to be honoring the Leon S. Peters Foundation in Fresno for their support of the Armenian Studies Program, and also celebrating Arnold and Diane Gazarian, who donated to create the Berberian Chair in Armenian Studies at Fresno State. The banquet will be on March the 22nd. Come out and join us if you're interested. And we got a lot of events, and so we hope to see you there. For All Things Armenian, this is your host, Professor Barlo Demirgardichian, and we'll see you next week.
Tune in to All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Este fue un programa pagado que solo refleja la opinión de nuestros anunciantes. Ahora continúa disfrutando de la programación de 1600 AM.
KGST Fresno 1600 AM.